Jason Cochran takes the curiosity of a journalist with him when he travels. He's a pioneering travel blogger and editor-in-chief at Fromers.com. Lately, Jason's written about how America tells its stories after visiting battlefields, disaster zones, and memorials, especially in his native South. He found the whole story about some of the country's most important monuments has sometimes gone missing. He explores this in his book called Here Lies America, Buried Agendas and Family Secrets at the Tourist Sites Where Bad History Went Down. Jason, good to have you back.
Thanks, Rick. I'm glad to be here.
So where did you travel to make this book, and why did you write it?
Well, I wanted to write it to sort of understand who we think we are. I wanted to go to the places that we collectively as Americans have decided were important in terms of our sacrifice to get to the place we're at today. And so originally I started with a very long list of places where bad things have happened, you know, so I had to narrow it down to places that were touristy, places that might have had a gift shop and a parking lot. So taking that set of major tourist sites, the places your dad would have taken you in the station wagon and pointed at the sign and say, that's where picket charged. That's where I wanted to go, because those are the places we've all agreed say something about America, because people tend to go to them in numbers. The places that are in charge of holding on to them and showing them to people and telling future generations why they should think it's important. And that's where it starts to get a little bit murky. When you start digging into the past of these places, you realize that they got to us through very circuitous means, and also so did the interpretation of them, so that what it might have meant to the person who lived it is different from what it meant to the person who put the statues there 30 years later to what it means to people now. It could be all different.
You talk about this notion that we have lies, frankly, about our past and our patriotic mythology that shape our perspective today, and they become sort of embraced and accepted as part of the story. What did you learn in general in that regard?
The concerted effort with which events in American history have been manipulated by others so that the future generations have a specific view of them is not a political book. It's a book about me driving around the country, having funny moments and strange moments at these different places I visit, and learning things I never would have expected about these places, like how they came to be. But there is sometimes, if you dig in the past of these places, there are politics of those times. I'll give you an example. If you drive through the American South, and I'm from Georgia, by the way, since the 1700s, my family goes way back. If you drive through the American South, in front of almost every courthouse in every small town, you'll see the famous little statue on a pedestal of Johnny Reb, the guy from the, you know, the Confederate forces. Every single town you go to, you'll find this. What I discovered in the course of researching this is almost never were those things placed there right after the Civil War. Civil War ended in 1865. But if you look at the next one you drive past, look down at the plaque, look at the year, I'll bet you anything it is probably from like the 1900 years or the 19-teens. And you have to wonder, this was 50 years after the fact. There's a story here. How did they all suddenly show up? So that's one thing I go into when
What is that story? Why all of a sudden did they want to memorialize that?
It was a concerted propaganda effort, for lack of a better word. It was an education effort, I think is the way they would have put it. Think about this. I mean, let's pretend that you're a resident of the South and you're probably 25 years old in 1900. And your grandfather is a mess because he had been through the war. You hear stories about how much land you used to own. And so you're upset that you don't own that anymore. So there's a lot of resentment happening in the South. So the children and the grandchildren of the people who went through the Civil War and, you know, suffered those blows and dealt those blows, they were the ones who came around to build these statues because they wanted to reframe, or at least expand in their view, the way people saw the South and what it thought it was fighting for at the time. I mean, obviously, there's people who will tell you even today that what they put on those statues is not the same thing that they would have written even in the 1860s, because the passage of time had colored things. But it was an effort. There were women's groups by the hundreds of thousands. These women joined these groups, and they would put out a catalog, and you could pick which statue you wanted. And then they would send their members to Hector and to lobby the local governments. They would make sure that those statues were never placed in the cemetery, which is where these statues should usually go, but make sure it was in front of the school or in front of town hall, where people would make sure to see it. So it was all an incredibly concentrated effort. And the result, I think, worked, because people don't even know about it anymore.
So that was, you write about the United Daughters of the Confederacy in your book. That was that group.
One of the largest groups. I mean, to get quickly an idea of how successful this was, in the 19-teens, when they were refurbishing the Times Square subway station in Manhattan, the designer of the station put little battle flags from the Confederacy in tile all around near the roofline in New York City, because the mother of the publisher of the New York Times above the station had been a member of the United Daughters of the Confederacy. Most New Yorkers don't even notice those battle flags from the rebels, you know, in their station, but they're there.
And they effectively change a whole nation's understanding about an episode in their history.
Yeah, and at the time, too, there was a sort of a detente between the North and the South. No one wanted a war to flare up again, which is, I think, what Reconstruction had been about, kind of. So there were, I think, people on both sides let the other one get away with whatever they wanted to as long as they weren't fighting.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's sort of how these things appeared unchallenged at the time, and how even now we don't talk about exactly how they got there. And it happens, by the way, on national park land, too. We're not just talking town squares. Mm-hmm. Even the statues within those parks were usually donated by someone who donated the land, who said you couldn't move the statue if you opened the park. Things get to us some way. And the people who set aside the land and put up the signs all had intentions.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're on a road trip through some of America's most notorious sites, where death, disaster, and destruction are its claim to fame. Our guest is the travel writer Jason Cochran. Jason's written Here Lies America: Buried Agendas and Family Secrets at the Tourist Sites Where Bad History Went Down. Jason's the editor-in-chief at Fromers.com. He writes several of their guidebooks. He co-hosts a weekend travel talk show with Pauline Fromer in New York City. Jason's website is jasoncochran.com. Let's talk about Civil War tourism, because the Civil War was a sightseeing attraction even when it was going on, wasn't it?
Foolishly, yeah. Huh. In 1861, Americans hadn't really experienced, you know, regular war. There'd been the Mexican War way over there, and it wasn't huge. So when the first battle looked like it was going to happen in Manassas, which isn't too far from Washington, D.C., some of the gentry in the middle class rented coaches to take them out 25 miles so they could sit on the side of the battle and watch it as they picnicked, if you can imagine. So you have now rich people in their beautiful coats or when they're looking through their lorgnettes at a battle of the Civil War, which, and you can imagine how it went. It went incredibly poorly because the battle was a disaster, one of the worst in the whole course of the war. The people were overrun by retreating troops. Some of them were injured. And one of them, a congressman from New York who was among the viewing party, raised his hand and said, "Excuse me, please don't arrest me. I'm a congressman from New York." And of course, they immediately arrested him, put him in prison, where he wrote a best-selling book about his adventure.
You know, so much of what we have today in America is, in our travels and in our sightseeing and so on, it's related to the Civil War, isn't it?
So much of who we are today. If you look back and you trace the wires through time, they all sort of plug into the outlet, which is the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And before the Civil War, you know, there were similar things I think you could probably stretch back to. But our genesis of the society as we know it now fractured then, and it stayed fractured.
And today, it has this interesting attraction. I mean, you write about Andersonville. It was like America's concentration camp, right? There's thousands of people killed there.
That's how we see it now. There were many Civil War prisoner of war camps, both on the North and the South. And on both sides, they were incredibly deadly. But the one that is only one, really, that's honored as a major tourist site is Andersonville in Georgia, which people in the South feel a little upset about because, well, how come there's not one in the North? This is the kind of thing we started discovering. Why do we honor this and why don't we honor that? That's also part of the politics of history and politics of how we're taught things. But this one showed up in Georgia, and it was one of the worst. I forget the number, but maybe 12,000 people in 2 years perhaps died there.
Yeah.
It's a sobering thing. You don't think of it, though.
You went to Antietam on your research?
Antietam is one of the very few. Usually when you go to these national park sites, it gets very boring very fast. There's these giant lead signs that talk about what this general did and that one and which maneuver they made, and you just fall asleep just reading the sign. There's a reason for that. It's because originally the War Department was in charge of these old battle sites before the National Park Service was created and took them. But with Antietam, it's one of the only places you can see past all of that, you know, verbose sort of play-by-play stuff, and you actually understand its history, its actual human history. Every year in early December in Antietam, which is not too far from Gettysburg, but it's in northern Maryland, there's something called the Illumination. And for every single person who was killed, wounded, or went missing on that incredibly bloody day, they put a candle. So really, I think there's something like 15,000 candles as you drive through this park in the dark, and they undulate over the hills like a little constellation that stretches way out past where your eye can see. And you realize every single one of these was a human being. Every one of them was someone's hope or child, you know. And it starts to really put it together. This isn't just some random thing in a book. This is real, with real lives and faces that we'll never see. And it can get very, very upsetting because finally, for once, you're connected with this disaster, which allegedly was supposed to be part of your fabric of your country.
But you're connected with candles and gauzy emotion rather than gritty reality. You wrote, yep. People never see the bodies. No one shows them the silent nope. screams of the bereaved parents. Do you get a sense that war is a little bit romanticized in the way we cover it in our sites?
Probably a psychologist could go on about it, but I think absolutely it is. When one fights a battle, whether you win or lose, you tell yourself that it was a noble cause. Right. You do it so that the pain of not only the memory, but of the experience and the result, so it's not so painful. It makes it better if you feel like you were right. That's one reason all those statues went up in the South, right? Because it made the South feel like we were still right. We'll break if you tell us we were wrong and we believe it forever. Mm-hmm. And it's just like that, I think, with war. It's funny. In the old days, we expressed that differently. And if you go to Westminster Abbey in London and you look at the statues, there'll be an army general or some sort of officer representing everyone who died. Right. Nowadays, we tend to be very individualized about, in Oklahoma City or down at Lower Manhattan. Every person gets their moment to shine and to speak from the past and say who they were and what was lost. It wasn't so much the case for most of American history. So it's interesting that the way we respond to them has slightly changed, but still at heart, we still want to say it didn't break us.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Jason Cochran, and his book is Here Lies America. And it's about visiting historic sites where bad things happened and great battles. Gettysburg is a big part of your book. It's a town that made a fortune off of a slaughter, isn't it?
On purpose. Yeah, back in the day, there was no way to collect fallen bodies of soldiers. So you would pin a note, my name is James, get me back to my mom or something. You'd hope that someone would find the note and do it. If you forget that Lincoln, when he showed up at Gettysburg 4 months later to deliver the Gettysburg Address, it was about, can we please agree to honor these people? And the reason he was saying that is in the fields around him at that moment, there were still Southerners from 4 months before who had never been claimed or who had been buried under an inch of topsoil, and then people would steal their plank headstones for firewood. It was a terrible scene. And so he was begging for some sort of national system for military cemeteries, which eventually we got.
So Lincoln,
but that's what Gettysburg was about. Let's honor Gettysburg, guys. What are we doing?
Lincoln actually went to Gettysburg and it was surrounded by still rotting corpses to give the Gettysburg Address.
In those first few months, it was July when the event happened. Gettysburg smelled so bad that residents were walking around with peppermint oil smeared on their upper lips. Mm. And the town was getting a terrible reputation. It's a dreadful name. So it needed to rehabilitate itself. So very soon after, very conveniently, they discovered a mineral springs that was great for you. So they rode that for about 50 years. Mm-hmm. But they also realized that people wanted to come and see about this place they'd heard about, often because someone they knew had died there or been injured there. What they would do is one state would put up a beautiful memorial and all the people would from that place would go and look at it, admire it. And so Gettysburg's city planners started putting really crummy, awful temporary signs on empty pastures saying, well, this is where Maryland's would be, essentially. And so people from Maryland would come up and get indignant and say, what? How come Pennsylvania has a great one and ours is terrible? And they'd go back and they'd lobby for a lavish new monument. Now Gettysburg is hundreds and hundreds of these monuments, like a chessboard after a game. But it's all because it was like an arms race, you know, amongst these different states to make it the best tourist site possible. All of that roots back to the fact that it was so embarrassed about what had happened there and horrified that it desperately needed to remake itself. And that was one of the mechanisms it could use.
And now it's got that Segway tours and ghost walks and still cashing in.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a big difference between dark tourism, you know, going to Chernobyl and going to these sites that I go to. You don't go necessarily to these sites because the horrible thing. You kind of go because this is America's horrible thing. And it makes you start to wonder, why don't we go to X place? Why we pick this place? And I also found some places that were complete 100% recreations that actually weren't that way. They've been built again so that people would have a place to visit. Ward's Theater being an example, you know, the real one collapsed in the 1890s. So it's very interesting to see where Americans have put their chips on what historical stories they want to tell and which ones they've completely left behind, like Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, which completely changed labor rules and the safety of workers. And the Colfax riot, which was a horrible slaughter of an African-American group of politicians because there was a rival group of white politicians that also wanted those seats. Really fascinating, terrible, dark stories that were completely left by the wayside for the ones that we chose. And I think exploring which ones are which says a lot about who we are or who we wish we were.
Jason Cochran is the author of Here Lies America. about the stories behind the plaques at many of America's monuments and memorials. Craig's listening in from Chicago at 877-333-7425. Hey, Craig.
Hey, Rick. It's a pleasure to talk with you, and hello to Jason Cochran. I've read a lot of books on war and notorious sites, and the one that sticks with me the most is Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. That, of course, is about the American Indian Wars of the late 19th century and what some contend is the genocide against the Native American. How does Native American history figure in your book?
When it comes to Native American sites, there's a good reason why there aren't many. At first, I thought the reason was going to be that Americans just don't care, which is true, I think, but that's not often the reason why there's nothing memorializing these places. In the case of Wounded Knee, it's a choice of the local people to keep the government out. The federal government does not control that land. It is their land, and they don't want a national park there because of, well, look who killed all these people to begin with, the federal government. So it's a choice. And it's also, among those people, it's more of a tradition to leave a grave untended. That's part of the culture. And so Wounded Knee is sort of an outgrowth of that. The fact we don't honor it, there's no big museum, you won't be able to go there and buy keychains. It's because the local people took control of the way they wanted to retell that story. There are ones that are controlled by our government. Sand Creek in Colorado is a good example. It was an attack just as heinous, really, as was Wounded Knee. Mm-hmm. But it's not often visited. And it's rural. A lot of these memorials where these horrible slaughters happened are in inaccessible places. That doesn't help. Right. But, Sand Creek, although they do their best to honor it, the buildings are temporary. The road to it is dirt. You know, the event is purely in your imagination because there's not a building or something you can point to. You just say it was over there in that field. So I think a combination of inaccessibility, unfortunately bad theatrics, which is part of the presentation of these places, and I think generally the way the American culture tends to write out the histories of these people and what the culture did to them back then, all these things sort of conspire to make them super minor. And there's not one that you could consider a major attraction or tour site.
Thanks for your call, Craig.
Hey, thanks, Rick and Jason.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Jason Cochran, and his book is Here Lies America, Tourist Sites Where Bad History Went Down. You put a lot of work and a lot of miles into making this book. Just to wrap up our conversation, what's the takeaway? What would you want people to appreciate about this whole dimension of our culture and our world
well,
as we can
I'd like
to.
Us to read the inscriptions a little more, to look at the plaque dates, to sort of ask why and how things got to be the way they are, because I don't think our mythology about ourselves always matches up with the actual history of ourselves. I think it helps to sort of know who we want to be as much as know what we did, because that's the way you sort of arrive at who we are.
All right. Well, congratulations on a fascinating book. Jason Cochran, Here Lies America. Thanks, Jason.
Thanks.
Jason Cochran has more to say about his own Southern heritage in an extra to today's show. You'll find it at ricksteves.com/radio. From America's past to America's pastime, the Ballpark Boys are next on Travel with Rick Steves.